I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We're going to be talking about the minimum wage this hour of the program because voters in countries all over the country have approved ballot measures in November to raise their minimum wages. And there are now a number of states in the country that have relatively healthy minimum wages. The District of Columbia, it's at $11.50. Massachusetts, Washington have $11. California, $10.50. Maine, Hawaii, Colorado, $9.30 for Colorado, $9.25 for Hawaii, $9 for Maine. And in Wisconsin, it's $7.25, which is the minimum wage. But there is a movement that's happening all over the country. And it, in terms of a big city, started in Seattle. Seattle officials voted 3 years ago to incrementally boost the city's minimum wage up to $15 an hour. They hoped at that time to improve the lives of low-income workers. So has it done that? And why is it that we're starting to see so many of the other municipalities and states in the country have an increase in the minimum wage, and it's being done either by cost of tying it to the cost of living, the increases. There are some who have done this by a ballot, a referendum, and others that have done it by legislative session. So we have two guests this hour to talk about the issue, and we've are expecting a lot of phone calls. Sylvia Allegretto is a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She is co-author of Seattle's Minimum Wage Experience, 2015-16, a study which analyzes Seattle's recent minimum wage increases. Sylvia, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's good to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. And Paul Sahn is also with us, General Counsel and Program Director for the National Employment Law Project. He was co-director of the Economic Justice Program at NYU's Brennan Center for Justice for a number of years. Thank you so much, Paul, for being with us. Hi.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. And our phone number, because we'll have a lot of people who will want to participate in this hour, I am sure, 800-486-8655. Email for the show is ideas@wpr.org, and Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Let's start with a look at Seattle, because it seems to be the big city that did this 3 years ago and did it first. I bet it has been very, very carefully analyzed. The data has been gone over very closely. Sylvia, what did you find in your study?
Yeah, in my study, we found that pretty much the Seattle minimum wage that is going to $15 an hour over a period of time, we looked at the first two increases, the going to 11 and then the $13 an hour. So this is an interim report, if you will. But we saw that it's pretty much working as one would expect and as the policymakers intended, and that is that we see increasing wages for workers in affected industries, especially the restaurant industry that are the heaviest users of low-wage and minimum-wage workers. So we see that they're getting a wage boost, but we haven't seen any negative effects on employment as of yet.
Mm-hmm. And it will go up to $15, what, in a couple of years?
Well, it's actually at $15
now. Oh, I'm sorry. It's going up more than that.
No, it's going to $15 now for large businesses, but that happened in January of this year, and we don't have the data yet. So there's always quite a lag time to get the data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is what we've used. So, you know, these reports will lag the actual increases.
Mm-hmm. There are studies, conflicting studies, I have read, Paul, on what's happened in Seattle. We have the study that we just heard about. Are there other studies that say that maybe there are some problems, that people are losing their hours, that jobs are being lost in Seattle?
Yes, there is a conflicting study that was released by a group at the University of Washington that received, generated eye-catching headlines. But when experts then dug into it and looked beneath the surface, they found really very serious problems with the methodology and which really, in our view, is make it not at all a reliable indicator of what's happening in Seattle. And really, one of the most detailed explanations of the problems can be found in today's New York Times. There's an upshot in the Upshot Economics column by University of Massachusetts Professor Aaron Dubay. He walks through kind of carefully what the issues are with the University of Washington study, and he actually is the one of the authors of the methodology that the study that the University of Washington team applies in that study, and so notably Dubé and one of his co-authors, Ben Zipper at the Economic Policy Institute, they have been among the leading critics, pointing out that the serious problems with the University of Washington study call its results into question.
Mm-hmm. Sylvia, what was the idea? What was the genesis of the idea in Seattle to raise the minimum wage?
Well, I think, as you said up top, there is a lot of action at the state level and at the local citywide levels of increases in the minimum wage over the past few years. And this is really due to the fact that the $7.25 minimum wage, that's the federal minimum wage, it's been in place since 2008, is woefully outdated and far too low. So what happens when we have this, you know, long periods of stagnating and not changing minimum wage at the federal level, we see a lot of action at the state level, and now we see a lot of action at the local level. So I think this is actually a good way to think about minimum wages. First of all, it's very democratic when we have voters and state legislators voting on these policies. And, you know, you have a lot of places like California and San Francisco and Seattle that are higher cost of living states. And so it's good that we can have these local and state minimum wages to address, you know, their own wage issues and put into place the policies that will help the lowest paid workers in those places. And I think the overall reason, you know, why minimum wages recently have gotten such attention is that, you know, through the great recession that is behind us, unfortunately the effects aren't, and we've had wage stagnation since then. We've had actually 30 or 40 years of wage stagnation at best for low-wage workers, and many low-wage workers actually making less than their counterparts did 30 or 40 years ago. And so in the long-term context, we see why there is all this movement on minimum wages.
Mm-hmm. And how do you explain that, Paul, less than the counterparts of 30 to 40 years ago?
Yeah, why the minimum wage has fallen so? I mean, it really, unfortunately, it's because of the role of it's because, you know, political polarization and the role of money in politics are really big factors in preventing Congress from regularly updating the federal minimum wage. I mean, raising the minimum wage used to be a bipartisan thing that passed regularly every few years with Republican and Democrats supporting it together. But with the growth of money in politics and the outsized cloud of special interest lobbying to keep wages low have broken that down, and Congress is, you know, the last time they raised the minimum wage was back in 2009. You know, before that it had been a very, very long time. So Washington is really sticking its head in the sand and leaving it to the states to deal with keeping wages at an adequate level. But you see that the states are very, very uneven, and some of the states, either through voter ballot initiatives or action by legislatures, are doing a good job of updating the minimum wage. But many states, you know, Wisconsin among them, really have not been dealing with it, and it's the workers in those states are really hurting.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody know the history of this, when we decided a federal wage in this country was needed, how long we've had it?
I mean, it was since the New Deal, when President Roosevelt championed the Fair Labor Standards Act, establishing the first federal minimum wage. Mm. And since then, we've had this sort of hybrid federal system where the federal Congress sets a national wage floor, and then states or cities can go higher than it. But one thing actually that's sort of interesting, though, to note, though, is that the $15 minimum wage, it did start in the kind of high cost of living cities and states, you know, Seattle, California, and New York. But it's, you know, the current, but now it's really gone national, and, you know, the current federal minimum wage bill that's backed by the leadership, Democratic leadership in both houses, calls for a $15 minimum wage nationwide by 2024. And that's actually backed up by cost of living data. If you look at the cost of living data, not just for the high cost places, but for Texas and Georgia and Alabama, a single worker, even supporting no children, will need $15 an hour to cover the basics by 2024. And that of course means in the high cost states and workers with children, they'll need even more. But wage $15 by the mid 2020s is what just a single worker will need to cover basic living costs, et cetera.
Yeah, I'm wondering what stories we have and how many people have been interviewed who've benefited from an increase in the minimum wage in Seattle. Do we know that? Are people able to go to restaurants? Is there a noticeable change in the quality of life for low-income workers, Sylvia?
Well, I mean, it's pretty early days. We do know that workers are getting raises, so that's always a good thing. But, I'm working with data, so I haven't been out on the ground interviewing the workers who are actually getting those wages. But we know in general, yes, it makes a big difference for workers who get increases in their pay, especially our lowest wage workers. They are, that's just common sense. So these workers and over the country, there's been millions and millions of workers helped with these increases in minimum wages. And so it's very, very important, not just for workers, but workers, their families, their children, whole communities, because many times minimum wage workers and low wage workers live in certain areas, and so that can help boost a local low wage area where a bunch of workers are low wage workers. So we do know it's happening, and there are certainly going to be stories trickling out on the positive side, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Yes, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I was going to say, and this movement for the $15 minimum wage, it really actually was launched by workers themselves. It was initially fast food workers, but then joined by home health aides and airport workers and retail workers who were, saying they just couldn't support themselves on their, $9 or $10 an hour paychecks, and that $15 an hour was the minimum they needed to live to make ends meet, and they really have continued to drive this movement, but their policy impulse that this is the minimum they needed really is borne out by cost of living analysis that shows that, as noted, everywhere in the country, soon a single worker will need $15 an hour, and in expensive places, where they'll need even more.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, we always have to keep in mind that these low-wage workers today are much more productive than their counterparts were decades ago. The economy has expanded greatly over this period of time. We're one of the richest countries in the world. But the larger context always has to be we are in an economy with many workers, but where the fruits of their labor are going to a very few. So this, you cannot have a discussion of minimum wages without really bringing in the ever-increasing and enormous, vast, difference between low-wage workers and the people who are gaining or taking most of the gains in our economy right now. Inequality, right? The inequality is vast and
yes,
growing. And so one of the ways that we can at least mitigate some inequality is to bring up the bottom. And again, there's no reason we should have, in a country as rich as ours, a term, the working poor. It just makes no sense. It's not good policy. It's just simply not fair. And so, the other thing about Paul talking about the U.S. minimum wage, don't forget that a $15 minimum wage in 2024 is not actually $15. And the fast food workers who were the pushing the $15 minimum wage, they started doing this about 5 years ago or so. So we're talking about the reason why now it's very viable and needed, for the whole country instead of just, low-wage workers in high-cost cities, is because much time has passed. And again, you see this stagnation at the federal level at 725. And so, as we move in time, and again, we keep getting richer, the economy is absolutely booming, we need to make sure that we get more money into the hands of working Americans.
And yet it doesn't look like anytime soon we're going to see a federal minimum wage increase, does it, Paul?
So, I mean, it's so hard for Washington to do anything, and the Republican Congress and the Trump administration appear much more focused on sort of rolling back protections for workers and strengthening them. But I should note, though, there was in early July, there was a proposal to add the federal $15 minimum wage bill to a sanctuary cities bill that was moving through the House, and the Democrats voted unanimously to try to add it to that bill. Unfortunately, the Republican leadership and majorities voted it down. But the $15 really is now the main minimum wage proposal in Washington. But when we'll see action on it is very uncertain given the polarization there.
Let's go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. The minimum wage has been raised in many states in the country and in municipalities. In Seattle, the first major city in the nation to adopt a $15 minimum wage, and that just went into effect in July, I believe, July 1st, the $15 minimum wage, but that is an increase that began in 2015, and it depends on the size of the employer, the benefits that are provided. So Seattle has been very heavily scrutinized. We're looking at why the movement is all over the country now, what it does for workers. Does it hurt employers? It's another question we will ask, and we wonder about you. Have you been a beneficiary of an increase in minimum wage? Probably not here in Wisconsin because it hasn't happened, but in someplace else. I'm sure you have relatives or friends who live in other places and are working perhaps for a lower minimum wage. What kind of difference does it make in day-to-day life? If you are one of those workers who's working a minimum wage job, what do you think would be fair here? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Eugene and Viola, our first caller. Hi, Eugene.
Well, good afternoon, Kathleen, and to your guests. I think the saddest situation in this whole situation on minimum wage, if you took everything that you could buy for a dollar an hour in 1950, a bottle of pop, a candy bar, as examples, and a flashlight, size 3D flashlight battery, you can go to the movies, it would now cost you about $24, $25. And I don't see that gap getting any closer. So we're working a lot longer, and I don't see us catching up. We were much better off, maybe we were better off, at a dollar an hour in 1950 than we are with the wages we've got today.
Sylvia.
Well, I think he's alluding to the wage stagnation that I was talking to about up front. And, another aspect that is important here and a reason why the minimum wage is so important these days is because we don't have the traditional institutions and unions, for instance, that help workers get their fair share. So workers are kind of on their own in an economy that is, again, stacked against them. I mean, we heard this over and over during the Great Recession, during the Occupy Wall Street movement. What is the truth? And that's an economy that's, not working for most of the workers in it and the workers that actually make it hum. And so that's why we're seeing such wage stagnation. That's why we've had these long-term trends. One of the biggest reasons is the decline in worker power that comes with unionization and collective voice.
Paul, you want to comment?
I mean, the caller is exactly right. I mean, and it's, wages haven't been keeping pace with prices. The gap is even greater if you look at what's happened with productivity or the stock market or CEO compensation. All of them are really through the roof, and whereas the minimum wage is lower now in real terms than it was. Far lower than it was in the late 1960s. It really shows a mismatch, and it's millions and millions of workers are being hurt by it. I mean, close to one in three of America's workers today struggle in jobs that pay less than $15 an hour. And it's not just workers flipping burgers. It's a really broad range of occupations or across our economy today pay less than $15 an hour. Probably close to half of social workers, large numbers of EMTs, large numbers of manufacturing workers, many of the caring professions, virtually all child care workers, home health aides, job. Many of these are top growth jobs in our economy in which, we rely for vital services, but which pay, not nearly enough.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Eugene, for your call. Teresa in Escanaba, Michigan. Hi.
Hi. I believe I heard recently that states, and I believe it was Missouri, are basically enacting or trying to enact laws to prohibit cities from raising minimum wages above the state level. Is that correct? And how do we stop this?
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. The caller is exactly right. It's a really... Many of the states are not only failing to deal with raising wages adequately at the state level, but they're tying the hands of cities to prevent them from doing it. And unfortunately, your home state, Wisconsin, is one of them, where they banned cities from raising the minimum wage. Then the legislature and Governor Walker banned them from guaranteeing paid sick days for workers. And we've seen the same threat in other Midwestern states. Actually, Iowa and Missouri are two where, because the state wouldn't act, cities and counties started raising the minimum wage. And then the conservative legislature stepped in to take away those raises, pay increases away from tens of thousands of workers. They tried to do the same thing in Minneapolis, but Governor Dayton stood strong and vetoed the proposal, which cleared the way for Minneapolis to become the first city in the Midwest to raise its minimum wage to $15 an hour, which it approved in June and is now phasing in. But it's a very serious problem that's really it's compounding the harm caused by the low federal minimum wage and by states not adequately raising minimum wages.
Mm-hmm. Sylvia?
Yeah, I mean it's really, as Paul is saying, the federal minimum wage in these cases of preemption mean that the federal minimum wage becomes more important because those states and even the pockets in those states, and these have been happening in states that have never had minimum wages above the federal level. This two cases in Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky, and Lexington, Kentucky, passed higher minimum wages. They were actually in effect, just like I believe in St. Louis, where workers, received those wages only to have the policy rescinded and overturned, and we don't know what businesses are doing. Interesting question. If a boss goes in and says, "Hey, we just gave you a raise to $10 an hour, but we're going to bring you back down to $8 an hour," that would be very interesting.
Right.
What they are doing, we don't know yet. But it is another reason why the federal minimum wage that is lagging so far behind is so much more important. It's $7.25 an hour. These states with preemption, now the only way any worker is going to get a raise in those states is through the federal minimum wage. And I just want to always chime in about the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. Being somebody who was a waitstaff and bartender for many years, the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers is $2.13 an hour and has been federally since 1991. So it really goes to show you that the National Restaurant Association, for instance, a very powerful lobby group, has really weighed in here. And so this is more evidence of what Paul was talking about and how you have policies. It's direct policies and, the wealthy people who are running this country that actually, put these policies in place. And now they're behind a lot of these preemption laws.
Olaf called to ask, how does a $15 minimum wage affect government benefits like food stamps, et cetera, are more eligible or fewer?
I actually have to sign off now, but I want to really thank you. But I know Sylvia can answer that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Sylvia.
Yeah, so, you know, this is an area where there's some work being done, and we need more work being done. And the good news is most benefits, you know, they have they don't just have a cliff. They kind of phase out over some period. So, you know, if you make more money, you don't just, you know, lose all of your benefits. But it is the case that, you know, we worry about some folks losing some or part of their benefits. But that's why we need to really strengthen a lot of areas, not just the minimum wage, but, for instance, the earned income tax credit. We don't think of the EITC as a replacement for the minimum wage. We don't think of it as a substitute for the minimum wage. We think of it as a complement to the minimum wage. And as minimum wages are strengthened, EITC should be strengthened along with a lot of other benefits, such as food stamps and such. So it is the case that we do have to look closer at these, especially the benefits that have cliffs. And if so, we have to make sure there's policies that address these issues as the minimum wages change.
Suzanne in Madison, hi.
Hello. I wanted to make 2 points. One, the issue of whether the minimum wage of 15 in the Seattle area is making a difference. There was just an article, I think, in Atlantic that said it is not working as they had hoped because employers are cutting their hours, the hours of the employees, which was the suspicion that would occur. The second point I'd like to make is, as your male guest just said, as an example of those who earn under $15 an hour, at UW-Madison alone, University of Wisconsin-Madison, Institution of Higher Learning, there are 500, almost all women, in University Services 1 and University Services 2 positions who do all sorts of clerical. They're essentially administrative assistants and really almost at a professional level. They're all earning being hired at well under 15 to start. And then all of the gardeners, all the landscapers, the many, many of the food service workers at university institutions and other state government. These are state employees. They are, everybody used to think it was great to be a state employee. Wages are low. Cost of benefits is going way up. And it's absolute stagnation. And it's just an indicator of how broad and deep the problem is. Thank you for
taking
Suzanne.
My call. Yeah. The 9 hours cut, I think we mentioned that early in the show, but if you'd like to amplify, please.
Let me just address what she was saying at the end of her comments. And we do know that low-wage workers are disproportionately women and minorities, so it's not surprising that you see in these, low-paying administrative jobs on campuses, gardeners, what have you, you're going to see a disproportionate amount of women and minorities. So that is usually the case across the board for minimum wage policies. It is not the case these days that most minimum wage workers are teenagers, for instance. The majority of minimum wages are hard working adults with families, and they've been working some of them for quite a long time without any raises. The at the top of her statement, she again was talking about what we talked about early in the segment, and that is the University of Washington report on Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
My report that we discussed that showed that the policy is working as intended. Low-wage workers, especially in the restaurant industry, have gotten raises, and there hasn't been any negative effects on employment. Again, the University of Washington report, and you can go and look at a lot of the places where Paul was just talking about, the Economic Policy Institute, Aaron Dubay, who on Upshot in the New York Times today, very thoughtful comments on the problems in the UW study. Now, they're a great bunch of researchers. They're trying to do a good job, but their results are very outside of the norms of any minimum wage research that we have seen. I can't overemphasize this more, that, you know, basically what the results show, that for every 5 folks who got a raise, 4 of them lost their jobs. So we're talking about kind of full-time equivalent workers. if it were the case that that was the result, there would be riots in the streets. There would be businesses closing down. It is just outside of any believability. And, you know, there's, again, we probably don't want to get into the weeds here, but they have some serious problems in the study, such as they excluded businesses of multi-establishment locations because of reasons that they couldn't do any different, because they couldn't tell if they were inside Seattle or not. And that was, I think, upwards of 40% of the sample that's lost. We don't have the data. Other economists don't have the data, so we could scrutinize it closer, and hopefully that at some point it will be released, and we'll be able to do that. But again, they found very large effects of the minimum wage at wages over $19 an hour. Again, a finding that's just not in the literature, and it just doesn't make sense that they had very modest wage increases. They've showed very modest wage increases, but enormous declines in employment. And that just doesn't make any sense. I mean, if you're a business owner and you had to pay just a little bit more, not very much more, because maybe you're already paying above the minimum wage, and again, the economy is booming up there, so this could be the case, why would you have to, you know, why would you have to decrease employment so much? So I think that they're working on, again, our paper and their paper were intermediate papers. The policy is being phased in. There'll be more reports put out along the way, and we'll see if they're going to improve their methodology and the problems within their analysis in the next revision.
Thanks, Suzanne, very much for your call. Sherman in Ashland, hi.
Hi. I have a philosophical question. Should business serve society, or should society serve business? That's my philosophical question.
Should business, what would you, should business?
Should business serve society, or should society serve business?
Well, I don't see that as, you know, that we have to do either of those. Businesses are basically in the business of profits, making profits. Sure, there are a lot of businesses that do good and do well. They're definitely, and they care about that. But they, you know, for the most part, businesses want to make money. So what we do want is a government that makes sure we have a level playing field, that makes sure that workers have a voice in their workspaces and their workplaces, as far as their pay and benefit package, their scheduling. We're the only advanced economy in the world that has no mandated vacation pay, for instance, no time off. You don't have to give workers health care. You don't have to give them, you know, any type of vacation or paid or holiday pay. Again, these are workplace benefits that unions, by and large, really negotiated for workers. And workers with their own single voices just don't have that power these days. So I think that what we want is an economy that's working well on all cylinders, and that means that you need a good government oversight, and government regulation that is going to make sure that you don't have what we actually have today, which is an economy that is out of whack, and it's not boding well for workers, their families, or our communities.
Is it hard, Sylvia, to come up with an amount that is going to really help a lot of workers? Does $15 an hour strike you as a place where the minimum wage should be for everybody?
Well, your question is a good question. And, you know, what we know empirically is that the minimum wage increases that my colleagues and I have studied, and many other people over the decades, have shown that the minimum wage increases at the state and the federal level over the last 30 or 40 years have not caused disemployment effects, have not negatively affected the economies, but they've given workers some modest raises. So that's the good news. But, you know, it kind of shows you that if you're not really butting up against, you know, where you're changing the labor market, you know, that you have room to move. For instance, I certainly believe at $7.25 an hour we have a lot of room to move before the great benefits of increasing minimum wage, again, putting hands in putting money in the hands of the most needy workers. And all the other benefits that go with minimum wages, by the way. I mean, there's a lot of downstream effects that we don't talk a whole lot about, such as you know, better outcomes for infant health and birth weight, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Those we have to start talking a lot more about. But, you know, we've shown that modest price increases can easily take care of most minimum wage increases. And we see, you know, lower turnover for businesses, and businesses, especially in the restaurant industry that are highly affected, have, you know, enormous turnover, which contributes greatly to the cost because of constant recruiting and retaining and retention of workers. But, you know, what is the sweet spot? We don't really know. I'm convinced that, you know, so far that the evidence of Seattle at $13 an hour hasn't really you know, gone beyond anything that the local economy up there can handle. And the same thing in higher minimum wage areas like San Francisco, or where I am here in Berkeley, or where I live in Oakland, for instance. So I think that what we know for sure is that minimum wages over the last several decades have been very low, and the increases that we've seen just have not caused any negative effects. And I'm very confident in saying that those minimum wages, you know, the costs did not outstrip the benefits. But I think now we are starting to get into at least the discussion of, let's get minimum wages up to, you know, first of all, most minimum wage increases historically have only, you know, covered lost ground because they stagnate for so long. And with increases in prices, you know, a lot of minimum wage increases weren't real increases. They were just making up for lost ground. And, you know, that the federal level at $7.25, again, we would have to go up above $10 an hour just to get back to where we were in the 1960s. So I think that we have room to move above that. But where that sweet spot is, we don't know yet.
Mm. I was thinking about, you mentioned San Francisco, Seattle certainly as well, Washington, D.C., New York City. All of those cities, it costs quite a bit of money in which to live in those cities. I don't know how minimum wage workers, when they were making less money, and even now, are able to live there.
Well, we do know that there's a lot of displacement of low-wage workers and families. There's a lot of gentrification in these areas. So even with the higher minimum wages, it's very hard for these workers, you know, to make ends meet.
Right.
Certainly, in these areas, you have a lot of workers coming in from other areas that are less expensive, right, to come in to do these jobs. So, you know, it's no cakewalk, even if you're making, you know, $10 or $12 an hour, because as the callers have said, you know, prices have gone up on everything that you can think of, especially in these cities. And so that's why you have low-wage workers. You know, you have a lot of the family members working. You have, you know, multiple families living in a single-family dwelling. You know, that's what they're trying to do to make ends meet. But again, we're the richest country in the world. These workers are very productive, much more educated than they used to be. We can do better by them.
Let's go.
Should.
Thanks very much, Sherman, for your call. And we go to Mary in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hello. Well, I appreciate the fact that you're very concerned about this, but I don't think the country as a whole is, because in Wisconsin, the majority party that was voted in is Republican. The majority party that was just voted into the United States Capitol is Republican. And the Republicans are totally anti-living wage. So I guess people just really don't care. So I appreciate the fact that you do, but I don't think this is going to go anywhere.
Well, I don't think that that's quite right. I mean, you are right about your assessment that the Republicans have come into so many offices, and they are not, many Republicans are not only not for a living wage, they're not even for a minimum wage. There's been many Republicans on record to say that they would like to abolish the minimum wage and have the free market determine the minimum wage, as if we had, again, a market that had a level playing field, you know, instead of the plutocrats that have taken over. And again, we don't have the equal voice of unions, for instance, that help workers get their fair share. But saying that nobody cares would definitely be not correct, because we do know that all of the movement in the minimum wages, which is why you're having this show, is because the activists have been out there. Workers have been marching in the streets for years now,
yeah,
to get higher minimum wages.
Thanks, Mary, very much for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We are talking about the minimum wage. A number of states and municipalities have raised minimum wages, many of them just in the last year. Seattle is the city that had the earliest minimum wage increase, 2013, and we know that there are a lot of studies that have been done about what's happened in Seattle. Has it hurt business? Has it not had an effect on business? What has it done for workers? And we're looking at whether or not there should be a federal increase in the minimum wage. It's at $7.25, or it's been for a number of years. Would that make a difference to a lot of workers in this country, or would it have a negative effect on employment? Our phone number, what do you think? We have some lines open for you right now. 800-486-8655 is the number. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network. Rick sends us this message. Over the years, we've lost unions, skilled labor, and in turn, lowered wages. What's being done to fix this?
I'm sorry,
We've lost unions, skilled labor, and in turn, lowered wages. What's being done to fix this?
Right. There's not a lot of change. We have private sector unionization is now below 7%. So that's just pretty unbelievable. I really believe in a market system as ours and a democracy. We have to have worker voice. We have to have the ability to have collective voice. And what a lot of people don't seem to understand is that they think workers don't want or like unions. And in many cases, we've made it impossible to form new unions and to join unions. And again, that's the institutions, that's the Labor Department, you know, the Fair Labor Standards Act and the Fair Labor Standards Board, making sure that workers can do that. As far as skills, I mean, we certainly still have skilled workers, but we do know that we've had pay stagnation in many industries and across many occupations, and many of them skilled. You know, it used to be that you had apprenticeships through unions, by and large, that helped the flow of skilled workers, especially the workers that we have shortages of now, like plumbers and electricians and such. And so, again, we have a labor department now that is fairly anti-labor. So I don't think, you know, we're going to see any investment, and we are actually seeing cuts in many of the resources that will help workers with their skills, to help workers get retrained, and so on and so forth.
Barb in Green Bay, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, it seems like there's an elephant in the room, and that is that the U.S. has a consumer economy. And without consumers consuming, doesn't the economy have a chance of collapsing? And doesn't it work for everybody to maybe raise those wages? That's my question.
Okay, Barb. Thanks.
Yeah, Barb is talking about the stimulus type of effect that you can get from minimum wage increases. But the truth is, again, that one of our biggest problems in this country, again, we have one of the richest countries in the world, very productive workers, a very educated workforce, more so than in time past. And, you know, one of the biggest problems we have is that our low wage, and not even just low wage anymore, I mean, we've had some serious wage stagnation even for the typical worker recently, certainly through the Great Recession. And so, you know, we do need to get the money into the hands of more people. When you have inequality to the levels that we have, it does start to hamper growth and economic expansion. And so this is minimum wages. Again, the reason why minimum wages are getting so much attention, it's one of the few levers that we have left that we can pull, that we can go in and we can pass a policy and increase the wages of those at the very bottom. But in some sense, we have a problem that's just as critical, and maybe even more so for more people, is all the wage stagnation that has been going on for the people that are actually above minimum wages. Mm-hmm. So people kind of, you know, above the 10th or 20th percentile, but below like the 60th percentile, you know, the broad middle class, the wage stagnation. And for decades, you know, the way families were doing better was because women were working more. Women were coming into the labor force and contributing greatly to family incomes. And that's pretty much played itself out. And so, you know, we do have a big problem of we're a very wealthy country, and it's the distribution of that wealth that is the issue.
Thanks, Barbara, for the call. Do you have an idea of what other countries do in terms of minimum wage? Do most countries comparable to ours, Western democracies, have minimum wages?
Well, I mean, many of them do. Certainly, you know, Canada, for instance, they have minimum wages, and many countries have higher minimum wages than we do. The interesting part is that most of those countries, that in many of them that have minimum wages and minimum wages higher than ours, they also have many other benefits that we don't have, many of the benefits that I was talking about earlier, again, having paid sick leave, having universal health care, having you know, paid maternity leave for mothers and fathers, vacation days, holiday pay. You know, our workers here are working more and more and more for less and less and less.
Matt in Madison, hi.
Hi. This is sort of a comment and a question. One thing that I've noticed over the years in the areas where cities have raised minimum wage is that employers that are dependent on labor for most of their output will wind up moving to the suburban areas directly around the city. And usually those either smaller cities or villages will offer incentives either from tax and set incremental financing or lower wages. So you have this exodus of what I would consider low-skilled jobs that will provide a decent wage. So things like manufacturing and other labor inputs versus service industries where the wages are always low, such as fast food jobs, et cetera. So how do you address that along with, say, if I'm a manufacturing company making a widget and I look at it's going to cost me $15 to make the widget in Seattle, $10 to make the widget 20 miles from Seattle, and $5 to make the widget in Mexico. And most of that is based around the cost of labor. Why should I stay in the city?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, a lot of the minimum wage workers in the city, for instance, there's usually not heavy manufacturing in most of the cities, but there are low minimum wage users of low wage workers such as retail, and certainly a lot of restaurants, fast food restaurants, limited service restaurants. You know, for most of these businesses, location means everything. You're not going to have a good restaurant that now you're located in Seattle and you're doing very well on you know, on a nice corner in the city, and you're going to say, I'm going to move 20 miles away. I mean, that's just probably not going to be a good business strategy. And we don't see much of that happening, by the way, because these are businesses, again, that are located where they are for good reasons. Now, for manufacturing, like you said, it's, you know, you can move to a lower-cost area. It's not costless. I mean, it does cost money to move to a lower an area that has lower minimum wages. Many times, if you move to other if businesses, for instance, want to move to other states with even lower minimum wages, they don't have the educated workforce or the skills that you may need. So again, that helps to determine where businesses locate also. But then in the end, like you said, you can offshore or go to Mexico if you really wanted to. And we see, obviously, with globalization, that's also happening. But I don't worry too much about, you know, most of the low businesses that use low-wage workers intensely as moving too much.
And Sylvia, that will do it for us. Thank you very much for all your information. Thanks.
Well, you're very welcome.
Sylvia Allegretto is a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California in Berkeley. She's co-author of Seattle's Minimum Wage Experience, 2015 to 2016. The study analyzes Seattle's recent minimum wage increases. We also thank Paul Son, who was with us some of the hour, General Counsel and Program Director for the National Employment Law Project. From 1999 to 2008, he was co-director of the Economic Justice Project at NYU's Brennan Center for Justice. Thanks to Gretchen Brown for producing this hour, and to Gretchen as well for on-air production. I'll be on vacation for a week. I'll be back the very beginning of August for my final 2 weeks on the air. But tomorrow, I get to see the puppy. I'm going to raise as a therapy dog, so it's pretty exciting. I'll put a picture of him on Facebook, I promise. Thanks for listening. Thanks for all of your calls. News is coming up momentarily, so until, I think it's the 1st of August. Have a good end of July.